Welcome to Dead Pilot Society, the podcast that takes comedy pilots from A-list writers that were sold and developed at networks but never produced and gives them the table reads they never got a chance to have. I'm Andrew Reich, the creator and co-host of Dead Pilot Society. So, we can't cook you a meal, can't take care of your kids while they're out of school, can't give you guaranteed paid sick leave or universal health care, but I think we can provide something that is pretty necessary at this moment, which is some laughs. You know, I keep thinking back to 2001 after 9/11. I was writing on Friends, and it was easy most of the time to feel like what we were doing was frivolous, and especially after 9/11. All these people were dead, the world was turned upside down, and we were sitting in a room cracking each other up, writing sex jokes. And then I read an article about all the funerals of the Cantor Fitzgerald employees who had died in the towers. And one of the widows that was interviewed said that the only thing that was getting her through the day was watching Friends. And, you know, it feels grandiose to call being a comedy writer a noble calling, but I am feeling grateful to all the people who do it and do it well. And Joe Port and Joe Wiseman do it very well. They wrote our pilot for this month. I love this pilot. It's called Eternally Yours, and it's just a really fresh take on a vampire comedy. Maybe you thought that was not possible. It's just pure escapism. And isn't that what we're looking for right now? Our cast was Ed Weeks from The Mindy Project as Charles, Brigha Helan from Good News as Liz, Asif Ali from Wrecked as Max, Vella Lavelle from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend as Emma, Tony Cavallaro from The Righteous Gemstones as Jesse, Yasser Lester from Black Monday as Benji, Matt Walsh from Veep as Mort, Mindy Sterling from Austin Powers as Phyllis, Brendan Scannell from Heathers as Steve the Blood Guy, and David Fumero from Power as Henry. So obviously our upcoming live shows are postponed for the time being. But follow us on social media to see when those get rescheduled. After this episode, we do have two more really great pilots already recorded. We've got them in the can. That'll get us through the next couple of months, and we'll figure it out from there. And remember, we do have 45 really funny dead pilots on the feed for you to listen to. So go back, see what you missed. You can even re-listen to some. I'll bet they'll seem even funnier right now because we need them to be funny so badly. So sit back and listen to Eternally Yours, followed by my interview with Joe Port and Joe Wiseman. And I don't know, think about what you can do to be kind and to help someone today. So here is Eternally Yours after a quick message.
Hi, it's Jesse, the founder of Max Fun, coming to you from the microphone at my home office where I am socially segregating. So we promised you a Max Fun drive this week, but things haven't exactly gone how we expected. So given the pandemic, we're going to postpone this year's drive. Events are still fluid, so we're hesitant to give you specifics about new dates. Right now, we have late April penciled into our calendars. We'll keep you posted about that. As it stands, a lot of our drive machinery was already cranked up. So for one thing, you might hear a reference or two to the drive in our shows, which might have been recorded before we made this decision. And here is some good news. There's a bunch of great bonus content available for all of our Max Fun members. If you're a member and you missed the email with instructions on how to listen, check your spam folder or log in at MaximumFun.org/manage. Also at MaximumFun.org/manage, you can change your membership if your circumstances have changed. We know this is a tough time for a lot of people, and we understand. You can also go to MaximumFun.org/join at any time if you'd like to become a member. During the next couple of weeks, what would have been the drive, we're going to do our best to be extra available to you. We've got some streaming events planned, some social media stuff. We know a lot of folks are isolated right now, and we want to help provide comfort in the best ways that we know how. You can follow us on social media, and we'll let you know what's up. During this tough time, I have been feeling really grateful for my community of colleagues here at Max Fun and for you, the folks who make our work possible. goofy as that work may sometimes be. Stay safe out there. We're thinking of you.
All right, this is Eternally Yours, the pilot, written by Joe Port and Joe Wiseman. It's Act One. We fade in. We're exterior an Austrian castle. Moonlight shines on a stunning castle. We hear sounds of festive music and revelers. A party's going on inside. Torches and lanterns light a nearby wooden gazebo in which a young couple steals away for a moment's privacy. They kiss hungrily, hands exploring each other's bodies. This is Charles and Liz. They're both in their late 20s. A Chiron tells us that we're in Vienna, Austria, and it's 1519 AD. We hear a voiceover from our hero, Max.
You know how in vampire movies there's always that scene? You know, the super romantic one where the woman begs the vampire she's dating to turn her into one, you know, so they can be together forever.
In the gazebo, Liz speaks to Charles.
So we can be together forever.
Eternity is no small matter, my darling Liz. Is it not enough that we have a long, happy life together?
What was that?
What was what?
The throat clear thing.
Oh, I wasn't aware. Maybe my throat's a little dry. Lots of dust in these Austrian castles this time of year.
It matters not. See, Charles, even your quirks I cannot get enough of. I want to wake up to that throat clear every morn and fall asleep in its warm embrace until the end of time.
Oh, Liz.
Charles pulls her hair back and sensuously runs his finger down the side of her neck. He sniffs her neck, taking in her essence. She whispers in his ear,
"Do it."
Music swells. Unable to control himself any longer, Charles opens his mouth wide, and we see his elongated vampire canines fully exposed. He plunges them deep into her neck, and she lets out a moan, equal parts pleasure and pain.
Yeah, but what they never show you is what happens afterward. And I'm not talking about right afterward.
We pan up to focus on the starry night and dissolve to the Seattle sky. We pan down to a comfortable-looking suburban home.
I'm talking way afterward.
A Chiron says we're in Seattle, Washington. It's 500 years later. It's the present day. We're in the Blythe home. It's Charles and Liz's bedroom. Note that throughout, unless specified, our vampires dress and act like normal people. No accents, other than yours, Ed.
Sorry.
No capes, etc. In juxtaposition to the romance of the previous scene, this moment could not be more mundane. Charles and Liz, by appearance unchanged in age, but now locked in the fifth century of an interminable marriage, suffer through another night of marital ennui. Liz is flossing her teeth and watching Dr. Phil in bed while Charles reads a book. He clears his throat. She shoots him a not-so-subtle look and turns the volume on the TV way up. There's a beat. Charles clears his throat again, more aggressively this time.
Oh, my God! Would you stop doing that?
Wow.
I know you don't have to clear your throat. You know you don't have to clear your throat. The only reason you're doing it is because you know how much it annoys me.
The two of them glare at each other for a long, tense beat. And then... and we smash cut to our main title, Eternally Yours. We're exterior of a veterinary clinic. Max, our hero, 27, idealistic, sure of himself, good-looking, walks his dog Sherman, an adorable mutt, named after Seattle Seahawk Richard Sherman.
This is a story of how I met Charles and Liz, and how I got them to believe in love again. Or possibly how they turned me against it completely. I don't know. We're still battling it out.
Max and his dog come to a veterinary clinic and enter.
But before I met them, I met the woman of my dreams.
We're interior the exam room of the vet's office. Max watches as his dog is being examined by Emma. She's 25, a cynical, commitment-phobic, beautiful veterinarian.
She was beautiful and smart and always knew the right thing to say.
Well, I'm not feeling anything in his rectum.
I really think he swallowed something.
Okay, sure, that's possible. Or it's also possible that you just want to ask me out.
Excuse me?
You know, I have a degree. I went to school for this, but word gets out that there's a new hot vet in town, and all of a sudden the waiting room is filled with a bunch of creepers with borrowed cats. So.
We do a quick pop to the waiting room, which indeed is exclusively filled with guys, one of whom, with a goldfish in a bag filled with water, checks his hair and makes sexy faces in a mirror. Back to Max and Emma in the exam room. Max's dog starts to heave a little, finally throwing up a tiny toy fire truck.
Or I'm actually just a good guy concerned about his dog that I rescued.
Oh, God, you are good, aren't you? Wait, why do you have a toy fire truck?
It's probably from the children's hospital. I trained him to be a therapy dog.
Okay, fine. Dinner Thursday.
We're at Max's apartment at night. Max and Emma are on the couch, curling up with the dog.
It had been an amazing couple of months.
I don't think we should see each other anymore, Max.
Well, it's been a few days since the last breakup, so I guess we were due.
Hey, don't do that. Don't dismiss my breakups. You know I have commitment issues. I will not be in a relationship with someone that won't let me break up.
Emma, I know you've been hurt before, and that you have a surprising amount of baggage for someone your age. But that doesn't scare me off, okay?
Emma is touched. Max makes her feel safe.
Now, can we get back together? It's been 9 seconds. You've had your space.
Okay, fine. I missed you.
And they kiss. We're exterior of the Social Security Administration. It's the establishing shot of a government office building. A sign outside reads U.S. Social Security Administration, Seattle office. We hear Max in voiceover.
Meet cute? Check. Girl who fulfilled my weird need to fix other people? Double check. It was almost too good to be true. Maybe it was.
Inside, in the bullpen, Max is in his cubicle. His friend Benji, an overweight fanboy, is in the adjacent cubicle. Benji's is unkempt.
That's what it says. Imagination.
Just reading the words. Benji's is unkempt and littered with superhero paraphernalia and fast food wrappers. Max's is neat and organized.
She's not married. Stop saying that.
Well, something's very weird. You've been together 2 months and she's never let you come to her house?
Yeah, she's messy and doesn't want me to see her place.
Yeah, probably a lot of clutter and husbands lying around.
Okay, can you just be supportive? Did I ruin it for you when you had that online thing with that person who was obviously a man?
Okay, yeah, I kind of wish you would have intervened before I flew to San Diego.
Max comes across something interesting on his computer.
Huh, this is weird. Some guy's been collecting Social Security since the beginning of the program? That would make him like 128.
Huh. I wonder if he eats a lot of dark chocolate. I've been reading, that's really good for you?
No, Benji, this is obviously either a mistake or some sort of fraud.
Oh,
I guess I should just look into it.
I'm hoping it's legit.
He takes a bite of a Snickers.
If that chocolate thing is true, golden.
And we go to the Blythe home later. This is the home of Charles and Liz, the vampire couple we met earlier. Liz is back toward the kitchen dining area of the open concept living area, setting the dinner table. Charles's brother Jesse, 28 and douchey, is nearby watching some soccer on TV. Vienna is playing Salzburg. I love that joke, guys. Charles is at the door talking with Steve, the blood guy, a weird guy in his 20s. Charles hands Steve money in exchange for a styrofoam cooler.
There you go. Thank you so much. So, do you ever wonder what we're doing with all this blood, Steve?
No.
All right, see you again Wednesday.
Charles starts to shut the door.
You want to hang out or something?
I don't think so, Steve.
We could go to the mall.
Bye, Steve.
Charles closes the door.
Okay, we really need a more normal Craigslist guy willing to sell us his own blood.
God, I miss feeding on humans.
Mm-hmm.
Liz has crossed in to grab the container of blood.
You know why we stopped, Charles. It's not nice.
You know what's not nice? Having to move every few years so people don't think it's weird that we don't age. Also not nice? Not having sex for 17 months.
That's great. Just mention that right in front of your brother.
We've all lived together for centuries. Not a lot of secrets. I know that Jesse shaves his entire body and that this is all spray tan.
Hey, I'm a personal trainer, okay? There are mirrors all over that gym. Okay, and if I don't spray, I'm just a tank top and a pair of weights moving up and down by themselves.
Liz crosses away.
This marriage,
Charles turns to Jesse.
This marriage is literally never ending. This will never end.
That's why I only marry humans. Have fun till they croak, then you get a new model.
And how's that working out for you?
Well, people are living a little longer than they did back in the day.
Jesse's wife, Phyllis, 60 and not very bright, approaches. She's over twice his age and could pass for his mother.
Oh, sweetie, have you seen my reading glasses?
On your nightstand, babe.
Oh, she gives
the exception.
She gives Jesse a kiss on the lips and crosses off. Jesse and Phyllis's fraternal twin teenage sons, Henry and Mort, both 15, enter through the front door. Despite being twins, Henry and Mort could not be more different. Henry is romance novel gorgeous. Think a young Robert Pattinson. Mort is short, pale, and cherubic. Think a young Danny DeVito. They enter mid-argument.
I said I'm sorry, Mort.
Whoa, settle down. Hold that energy in, pal. What's the problem?
The problem is, Dad, the only girl I like in the entire school is in love with Henry, and I don't get it, Dad. He's not even funny. He just stares off and he says weird stuff like, oh, there's so much pain in the world.
It hurts sometimes.
And we're twins. Why does he get all the good traits? Super strength, super speed. I'm half vampire too, you know. All I get is can't go out in the sun.
Hey, bub, you can read the dog's mind. No one else has that.
He indicates Argus, the family's slothful basset hound.
Right. Wonderful. What's that, Argus, buddy? Huge news, everyone. He's hungry.
Phyllis crosses in, concerned, having overheard something.
What does he mean, half vampire?
Here we go.
Oh, my God. Is that why none of you age? It's not just good genes? Are you all vampires? Are vampires real?
Mort, what did I say about talking like that in front of your mother?
Okay, I got this one.
Liz waves her hand in front of Phyllis's face, wiping her mind.
You didn't hear anything, Phyllis.
A beat, and then Phyllis awakens. She turns to the kids.
Oh, hey, kids. How was school?
They ad-lib good and fun, and Phyllis crosses off.
All right, can we eat now?
In just a bit.
How long does it take to pour blood into some glasses?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we'd wait for our daughter so we can eat as a family because some of us actually enjoy talking to each other.
Oh, here she comes.
The door opens, revealing Emma.
Hey, guys. Sorry I'm late.
And now you know what I would come to learn. My girlfriend was a vampire.
Ooh, did Steve have steak this week? That blood smells delicious.
And as the gang heads for the dinner table, we fade out, end of act one. It's act two, we're in the dining room. Our vampire gang and Phyllis are gathered around the table. Phyllis eats food while everyone else pushes theirs around on their plates. Liz mimes taking a bite with an empty fork.
Oh, another triumph, Phyllis.
Everyone else ad-libs really good.
Yeah, it's so good.
We cut quickly to under the table. Six sets of hands sneak food to Argus the dog. Then we cut back to above the table. Jesse lifts a glass of blood, which everyone except Phyllis has in front of them.
Okay, I'd like to make a toast to my boys, Henry and Mort, who combined for 52 points and 34 rebounds last night while leading the Wildcats to a victory.
We play games. While the world is at war.
Okay.
Dan, I know you're just trying to be nice, but everyone knows I'm not on the basketball team, so when you say combined...
Still technically true. Love you, boys.
They all clink their glasses and start to drink their blood. This is the highlight of their day, and they really savor it. It sends them into a bit of an orgasmic stupor for a moment, their eyes closing in ecstasy.
Wow, you guys really like your VA juice.
Phyllis shrugs and drinks from her glass of white wine.
So, Dad, do you think we could maybe get some driving time in this weekend? I mean, I need to practice for my license. I promise I'll be really careful with the Trans Am.
Okay, you better, because it's a classic. Met your mother because of that car. I pulled up next to her at a stoplight in 1985, and what did I say, honey?
I'm already seeing someone, but you're hotter.
And she was.
Jesse and Phyllis share a loving smile. Charles pushes back from the table and crosses to the TV.
Touching story. We done? I'm going to go and watch the Lions.
Yeah, football's on tonight?
No, Nat Geo Lions of the Serengeti. I just need to see something kill something.
And we angle on Liz and Emma. Liz eyes Charles from across the room.
Look at him, watching his stupid program while I do the dishes. Again.
Are you kidding me? How do you not catch that?
Typical Lions.
So, just say something, Mom. Why don't you guys work on your problems instead of snipping at each other all the time?
I would love to work on things, Emma. I've been trying to get your father to go to therapy again, but he hated the first time.
And we cut to a flashback to Vienna, 1896. Charles and Liz sit on a sofa across from the legendary father of psychoanalysis, Sigmund Freud.
You know what? I'm feeling pretty blamed right now, Dr. Freud. You just keep on taking her side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's enough for today. This week, remember, be kind to each other. And Charles, try to suppress your desire to sleep with your mother, okay?
He keeps on saying that. Why do you keep on saying that?
And we go back to the present. Liz and Emma are as we left them.
Now, anytime I bring it up, he just refuses to even consider it.
This is why I'm so messed up. How can I have a successful relationship with you two as an example?
Hey, hang in there. It's going to happen for you.
Thank you, Uncle Jesse.
Well, assuming you're not completely broken. I mean, you've been dating for, what, like 150 years? So that's going to leave some scar tissue.
Jesse cracks a beer and exits. Emma is on the phone in her bedroom. We intercut with Max, who is exiting his car on the phone.
Hey, I know I act crazy sometimes, but I'm lucky to have you.
Well, I'm lucky. I have to finish up this work thing, and then I could swing by after work and pick you up for the movie?
I'll just meet you there.
Okay, Emma, what is going on? Okay, why won't you ever let me come to your house? Listen, whatever you're hiding, you don't have to be afraid to tell me.
My family, we're different.
I'll understand, I promise.
Okay. The truth is...
She looks around, then sees Seinfeld playing on her TV.
We're Jewish.
What? Why would I care about... Oh, God. Is this because I got Samuel L. Jackson and Lawrence Fishburne confused the other night? Seriously, I'm very woke.
Yeah, it's not you. It's my father. He just won't like me dating someone not like us.
Okay, hey, you want to wait? We'll wait. But when they finally meet me, they're gonna love me. Listen, I gotta go. Shalom.
What?
Max hangs up, arriving at the door of a suburban home. He rings the doorbell. Charles answers it. We realize Max is at the Blythes' home.
Can I help you?
Hi. Yeah, my name's Max Cipolletti. I'm a criminal investigator with the U.S. Social Security Administration.
From inside, this gets Jesse's attention.
It's come to our attention that a Jesse Blythe listed to this address has been collecting benefits since 1935.
Is that weird?
God damn it, Jesse.
Listen, it's probably a clerical error, but I'm going to have to speak with all the adult members of the household, ask a few questions.
Jesse waves his hand in front of Max's face, attempting to wipe his mind, a la what they did earlier to Phyllis.
Actually, you will now be on your way. Because everything is good.
Right, that's what I'm trying to determine. Why'd you do that thing with your hand? What is that?
Oh, shit.
Does that only work on weak-minded people, or is my mom weak-minded because you guys do that to her so much?
I chicken or the egg, I don't know.
Obviously, it's a misunderstanding. Jesse is a young man. Do we really need to jump through these hoops?
Well, down at HQ, they like to say I'm an officer who plays by his own set of rules. But those rules happen to also be actual rules. So, yes.
Max enters and crosses into the living room. Charles turns to Liz.
I hate this guy.
Wait. Aren't you supposed to call first or send us a letter or something?
Yeah, we deal with a lot of elderly, and they're kind of, well, protective of their benefits. And we find when they're prepared for our arrival, it's not good. You know, there have been some cane attacks.
Mm.
Last month, I suffered a puncture wound from a knitting needle.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, the perp sent me chicken soup and a $5 gift card to Old Navy, but yeah, it wasn't pleasant. So look, I don't want to be here any more than you want me here. Okay, honestly, I'm only doing this to put myself through grad school. I'm getting my master's in psychology.
Psychology. So you're sort of
like a therapist.
Well, you know, studying to be one.
Hey, would you mind if my husband and I were interviewed together?
And we go to the library of the Blythe home. Max sits in a chair across from Charles and Liz on a sofa. It's the same setup we saw when they talked with Freud.
And that's why sometimes I feel like Charles is listening, but he's not hearing.
Charles glares at Liz, then turns to Max.
So to answer your question, 3 months. We've lived here 3 months.
Uh-huh. And what do you two do for work?
Well, Charles is in financial planning.
And we cut to West Coast financial offices. Charles sits across from a middle-aged man and woman.
So do you think we'll have enough for retirement?
Absolutely. The good news is most retirements only last 20 years, and then you get to die.
Get to die?
Do not take that for granted.
And we come back to the scene in the library.
And I'm a professor of history at Seattle College.
And we cut to the Seattle College lecture hall. Liz is lecturing a group of students.
Sure, he started some wars, but at a dinner party, Napoleon was actually, he was an absolute delight. Although once he got so drunk, he just whipped it right out, right at the table. And let me tell you guys, he should have had a complex because that was a little man, if you know what I mean. According to many historians.
And we're back in the library.
Although Charles isn't supportive. In fact, he's against the whole idea of a mother working.
I'm sorry, that was just unheard of where I grew up.
Max checks his sheet.
In Cincinnati in the early 90s?
I'm just saying I make enough money that it's not necessary.
Tell us, Max, as a therapist, who do you think is right?
Okay, again, I'm not a therapist yet, and even if I were, I'm not your therapist. And also, therapists don't really pick sides.
They were right, but if you had to choose.
Fine, Liz is right.
Liz pumps her fist. Charles glares at Max. As Max talks, we see Charles subtly dilate his pupils and will a vase from the mantle to begin floating toward Max with the goal of smashing him in the head. Liz sees what he's doing and counteracts this action with her own dilated pupils. The vase moves jerkily toward and away from Max's head, as though a tug of war were taking place with it. Max is unaware of the vase.
Can I tell you guys a story? My parents loved to dance. They met at a high school dance, actually. But as the years went by, they stopped. You know, life got in the way. They went through a rough patch. Now, I'm a little bit of a romantic, so for their anniversary, I got them tango lessons. It reminded them how they used to be. You know, Charles and Liz, whatever it was you loved to do when you were first together, rediscover that passion. Find your dance.
Liz wins the tug of war over the vase and it flies out an open window, crashing harmlessly off screen.
So we're done here, we're good?
Well, yeah, as long as everything checks out with Jesse and Phyllis.
Short time later in the living room, Max is across from Jesse and Phyllis. Jesse twitches his leg nervously. He's sweating. It's not going well.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you just go through that timeline one more time, please?
Oh, yes. Okay, well, we met in 1985. We were both 28.
In the Blythe Holmes kitchen, Liz is with a panicked Charles. In the background, through the kitchen window, we see Henry and Mort playing basketball in the driveway. Charles peers out into the living room, seeing the interview with Jesse not going well.
This isn't good. He's not satisfied with his answers.
I don't want to move again. I love Seattle. We can be outside almost every day because of the cloud cover. Damn, I didn't want to watch that stupid Twilight movie, but they really nailed it.
And we cut to a flashback a year ago. The Blythe family watches Twilight together. It's the scene at the end where Kristen Stewart's Bella is asking Robert Pattinson's Edward to turn her into a vampire. Kristen Stewart on the TV.
I dream about being with you forever.
As Robert Pattinson considers this on the television.
Don't do it! Get out of there, Edward! For fuck's sake.
Liz just glares at Charles, and we come back to the present in the kitchen. Charles and Liz are there as before.
We are not moving. We're going to kill him.
Are you out of your mind?
In the background outside, we see Mort struggling to dribble as Henry steals the basketball and executes a Jordan-esque dunk.
We are backed into a corner. Plus, do you miss hunting and feeding? Remember those nights long ago? The anticipation, the chase, the blood pumping into our veins as we sucked it up.
pumping and sucking and pumping and sucking.
We did used to have fun.
Oh my God, that's it. Max said it himself. Find our dance. Hunting and feeding on humans is our dance.
I don't think this is exactly what he meant.
And we hear Jesse off screen.
Okay, wait, bro. I don't. You're not getting it.
Charles and Liz hustle into the living room to see Max heading toward the front door.
Again, I was born on a leap year. That's a lot. It's like 7 5 years.
I'm really sorry. There are just too many inconsistencies here. We're going to have to open a wider inquiry.
Max opens the door to leave. Steve, the blood guy, is just walking up to the house with something in a brown paper bag.
Hey, guys. I think I shorted you a little bit of blood earlier. I'm a little lightheaded, but here you go.
Not now, Steve.
You want to play some board games?
The door slams shut by itself, and the deadbolt locks.
What the fuck?
Max turns to find Charles and Liz transformed into their more vampiric selves. Fangs extended, fingernails like claws, skin pale, and eyes a disturbing yellow. They both let out hisses.
I'm really sorry about this. We're really not bad people.
Hold up. Are we eating him? Let me go get the boys.
Jesse rushes out. Charles starts to close in.
Okay. You know what? I'm dismissing the case. It's closed. You are good to go in the eyes of the U.S. Social Security Administration, please.
Charles and Liz go in for the kill when we hear off screen.
What's going on?
Emma, having heard the commotion, is coming down the stairs.
Emma?
Max?
You know him?
A beat as everyone tries to understand what's going on.
This is my boyfriend, Max. Max, these are my parents. We're not Jewish.
And we fade out, end of act two. It's act three. It's a short time later in the dining room. It's the most fraught, awkward meet the parents sit down ever. Emma and a stunned Max sit across from Charles and Liz.
More tea, Max?
No. I'm good.
So Michigan undergrad, huh? That's a good school.
Okay, I'm sorry. Maybe I should go. Can I go? I'd really like to go.
Dad, you're not saying a word. He doesn't feel welcome.
It's not just that.
Well, what is it? The almost killing you thing? Everyone apologized.
What do you want me to say, Emma? I don't want you dating a human. There. And worse, you lied about it.
I knew you'd react this way.
Well, you were right. He's not one of us. What about Ivan?
Dad, we broke up.
You can work things out. He's got his own business. He's a vampire.
Who still feeds on humans.
Occasionally. And even then, just really evil people.
He ate a guy for cutting him off in traffic.
Well, they can't all be the worst of the worst, Liz.
Is this Ivan a jealous type?
Okay, I'd like you to leave now. And if you say anything, we will kill you.
Nice meeting you. Wait, Max, wait.
She grabs his arm and he reflexively recoils.
What? I can't touch you now?
I'm sorry, Emma. This has been a really long, really weird day. Okay? And I just want to go home. Okay? I just found out vampires are real and my girlfriend is one. So if someone could please unbolt the door with their mind, I'm ready to leave.
Charles unbolts the door and Max exits in a hurry.
Thanks a lot, Dad.
Emma crosses out. Liz shakes her head at Charles.
You just don't get it, do you? This is not about you and what you want. This is about Emma. So she's in love with a human. Guess what? You fell in love with a human once too. Or are you sorry that that ever happened?
Of course I'm not sorry, Liz.
It's a nice moment, and then...
Oh, for God's sakes, take a Claritin!
We're interior Max's apartment later. He's there with Benji, with whom he has just shared the news about Emma.
Wait. So many questions. First off, like, what do you think her number is?
What?
Like, let's just say, conservatively, she's been with one guy a year. God. Like, and how old did you say she was?
Benji, this is not helping. Okay, I don't need perfection. But when it comes to a potential mate, I'd like her to be, you know, alive.
Boo! Oh! So the girl of your dreams turns out to be undead. You met someone you're really into. Do you know how rare that is? So yeah, she sort of has like a weird family sit.
They tried to eat me.
But she's beautiful and funny and screwed up enough that it keeps you interested. Don't throw something special away just because it's not exactly what you were looking for.
Benji's words get through to Max.
That's what the dude told me when I showed up in San Diego. I didn't listen, but it's still good advice.
I guess Emma is pretty amazing. Aside from, you know, literally being a monster.
Oh, God, this is your moment, Max. It's like all those rom-coms you claim to be flipping through whenever I walk in the room when the guy realizes he loves her, but things are kind of tough. Does the movie just end? No. That's when he crashes the wedding or rides up in the white limo and wins back that street hooker.
This is when I fight for her.
Yes, exactly. So what's your big gesture, Max? What are you going to do?
A beat as Max thinks about this. He notices the dog, Sherman, chewing something. Max pulls the object out of the dog's mouth, and we see it's the small fire truck toy from the scene in which Max and Emma met.
Oh, I think I might have an idea.
And later, we're exterior of the Blythe home. It's a peaceful afternoon. In the distance, we hear a siren wail, and a fire truck rounds the corner. Max hangs out the side as it pulls up in front of the Blythe home. On Max's command, the driver sounds the horn. It blares, and Charles, Liz, and Emma emerge from the house to see what the commotion is. Max talks over the loudspeaker.
Emma! I'm here to fight for you. Not physically, but with a grand romantic gesture.
He won't go away. He's like the plague, which I witnessed and preferred.
Max hops off the fire truck and runs up to Emma.
I don't care that we're different. Okay, I don't care that you can't go a week without breaking up with me. I don't care that you're unable to metabolize food. I'm crazy about you and I want to be with you.
Emma throws her arms around Max and they kiss.
You got that fire truck. You got that the fire truck thing was from when we met with the dog.
Yes, Max.
The fire truck honks and pulls away. Max calls to the driver.
Thanks, Jeff.
He's an old buddy. We met when my roommate Benji left a candle unattended at my apartment. The first time.
Excuse me, I am still not okay with any of this. Also, he shows up in a truck and everything's fine. That still doesn't change the fact that he is a human.
To a passing jogger.
Hey, how you doing? Lovely day.
They all smile pleasantly and wait for the jogger to pass.
You know what? I don't care what you think. This is my decision.
He's only around for 50 or 60 years anyway. I mean, you're stuck with us forever, so you better care.
You're being incredibly unfair.
Well, life is tough, and then you continue not to die.
They bark back and forth for a beat, their anger crescendoing, then finally...
Hey, guys, I think I have a solution.
They all stop and turn to Liz.
What if we made Max a vampire?
Are you insane?
It's a win-win. Everybody gets what they want.
I don't really want to be a vampire.
Please. Max, please stay out of this.
I don't want him to be... I don't want him to be one either.
Charles, you said him being human was the whole problem.
I was being nice. You want me to say it, huh, Emma? Fine. I don't like him. He annoys me. And being stuck with Max forever, not the solution I'm looking for.
Are you really going to be this selfish? What about your daughter?
I really like Max, but we've only been seeing each other a couple months, and this is kind of a major escalation commitment-wise. I mean, not to be rude.
No, I get it. I'm not on your not turning me into a vampire side here. Yeah.
Mr. Big Gesture.
Let's say we did do this. Let's say we did do this, Liz. And then they break up. We'd still be stuck with the guy. He'd be one of us. He'd have to join our coven and move in.
He could move out, maybe, if that happened.
Mom, he wouldn't be safe on his own. What about the werewolves and the vampire hunters?
Werewolves?
They're mostly harmless. 28 nights of the month. Okay, fine. You know what? Whatever. Clearly, you guys aren't into this idea. I was just trying to help. Do whatever you want.
Great. Then I'm going to keep dating Max.
No, you are not.
It's not up to you.
You know what? No. We're going to do this right.
Max approaches Charles.
Charles, I know that you only recently found out about Emma and me, and you're processing a lot of stuff. And I want to give you your time, but I also love your daughter. And I don't want to lose her. So how about this? I'm not asking to marry her. All I'm asking for is a chance to keep getting to know her. That's all. Literally the smallest commitment possible.
I'm comfortable with that.
So what do you say?
A beat as Charles considers this. He takes in the pleading stares of his daughter and his wife.
Fine.
Liz smiles. Emma runs up and hugs her dad. It's a nice moment.
But if he treats you badly in any way, we eat him.
Sure, Dad. You got it.
Emma shakes her head at Max. He's kidding. Behind her, for Max's benefit, Charles nods. I'm not kidding.
You won't regret this. Thank you. Emma, I'll pick you up tonight at your house because I do that now.
He smiles and turns to head off, and we hear him in voiceover.
And there you have it. Boy meets girl. Boy nearly loses girl. Boy wins girl back with big romantic gesture. It was a real-life happy ending. That is to say, I was happy right when it ended.
We hear tires screech. Max looks up just as a 1985 Pontiac Trans Am slams into him and sends him flying to the pavement.
Damn it, Mort!
We see Mort was driving the car. Jesse in the passenger seat giving him a driving lesson. They emerge to join Charles, Liz, and Emma, staring down in shock at Max's body.
He came out of nowhere, I swear. I think the brakes need servicing.
Do not blame the Trans Am, Mort.
Max, are you okay? Max?
We have to get him to a hospital.
There's no time. Look at him. We have to do something.
There's a long beat as the only option begins to sink in.
Hey, what about turning him into a vampire? I mean, that would fix this. What's kind of the temperature everybody's feeling here on this one?
He might pull through.
Dad.
Okay, fine. Damn it.
And we cut to an overhead shot.
And that's how I joined my new family. The day I died. Or I guess, technically, they made me undead now, is how you would say it. Yeah.
Together, they start dragging Max into the house by his legs, across the street, up the sidewalk, up the path.
Has it been smooth sailing? Not always, but that's to be expected. All families have their problems, and we're no different.
You're doing the right thing, Charles. This is the man I fell in love with.
Thank you, Liz.
They share a nice moment. And then...
Can you please call Dr. Feldman?
Max's head bangs off the stairs as they drag his body into the house and shut the door.
Our problems just happen to last forever.
We hear Phyllis off screen.
Oh my God! Why are you biting that man's neck? What is happening?
Guys, I got this one.
We fade out, end of act three. We're in the tag. We're in the tag. It's the Blythe home a few days later. Benji helps Max unload his belongings from a U-Haul truck.
So yeah, that happened. I moved in shortly after. I had a lot to learn about my new life, including how to control my new urges.
Benji unloads the last box and he and Max bro hug it out.
Oh, something smells amazing. Did you have pizza and wings last night?
Nah, I crushed all that this morning.
Yeah, you better go very quickly.
Benji heads back to the U-Haul.
Hey, thanks for your help. See you at work. Seriously, go. Lock the doors.
And we're in the backyard of the Blythe home. Jesse and a freaked out Max stand on the edge of the roof.
To be honest, it's been a bit of an adjustment.
Okay. It's all about your attitude. You just gotta jump. You jump, and then you think about flying.
Jesse jumps, levitates for a beat, then lands gently back on the roof.
Oh, shit.
The family sans Phyllis enters from the kitchen.
Max, what are you doing?
Jesse's teaching me how to fly?
Jesse, that's an advanced power. He may not get that for a long time.
Oh, still no powers, Max?
I don't know. I feel stuff percolating.
He hears the dog bark.
Dog's hungry, by the way.
Mort throws his hands up, annoyed that he's no longer special, and crosses off.
All right, buddy. You'll never know until you try. Here we go. Baby bird needs a little push. All right, ready? And one, two, push.
Jesse pushes Max. He falls like an anvil, and we hear a bone snap as he lands awkwardly in a planter. Everyone winces.
But with the help of Emma and the rest of them, I'm sure I'll get the hang of it.
Okay, that'll heal. That'll heal. You're a vampire now.
So much pain in the world.
And we fade out, end of show.
I usually start by telling the writers my favorite joke from the pilot. Oh. And there were a whole bunch with this one. It was kind of hard to decide. I guess it came down to a couple. There was when Jesse says, "Are we eating him? Let me go get the boys." I love that. I love his enthusiasm and wanting to include his sons. That was definitely a favorite. And then Charles, life is tough. And then you continue to not die, which just summed up his whole worldview.
Sure.
I love those. I love this pilot. I can't wait to get into talking about it more.
Great.
I want to thank you because it was so fun to get to hear it read after, it's been a few years since we wrote it. And I love that you do this podcast because it's like it's a great service, I think, for people who, like us who never got to hear it.
You're so welcome. Seeing you guys enjoy it is a great reward. When you're a writing team, and I know this having been in a writing team for many years, and you take lots of general meetings and you take all kinds of meetings, and everyone, the first thing they want to know is, how'd you guys meet? How'd you start writing together? So I'm sure you guys have told this story hundreds of times over your career, but I'm going to make you do it again. This will be the official record since we're recording. So let's talk about how you met, how you teamed up, how you got your start writing.
Sure. Well, we should have come up with a lot of embellishments because it's not that great of a story. But basically, we were both assistants on the animated show Dilbert on the UPN some 20 something years ago. I was a writer's assistant. I think you were the PA. And it was an animated show. And so there was just a lot of downtime. And we were literally in the same cubicle together. So after playing...
Much like Dilbert.
Much like Dilbert, yeah. So I think after we played maybe hundreds of hours of PC, the computer game, golf.
Minesweeper?
No, it's golf.
Yeah.
And, but we were like, we should be doing something productive. And we both wanted to be writers. And so we wrote a spec King of the Hill together. And it just so happens that our boss at the time, Larry Charles, the guy who created that show, got a hold of it. We were being picked up for the second season around the same time. And he's like, "Do you guys want to be writers?" And we're like, "Yes." So that's how we got.
Yeah. Larry Charles is a hero in the Port household because he gave me my first writing job and he gave my brother Moses his first writing job on Mad About You. Oh, wow. That's how I got the PA job on Dilbert.
Because that's what I was going to ask, because you skipped over for a lot of people trying to break into the business.
Yes, sure.
Important
yes.
step, which is how did you each get that job on Dilbert? Because that's the hard thing to do is
yes.
to get that first business job.
Mine was nepotism because my brother heard that Dilbert was looking for a PA, and he said my brother is trying to get a PA job. And then 20 minutes later, I was meeting with Larry, and he said, "I think you have a good vibe." And then he hired me, and that was how I got that job.
So Moses had already, he was already working, your brother was already working on...
He had worked the previous year with Larry. Larry had left to Mad About You to do Dilbert and create shows. So, but Moses was on Mad About You at the time still.
Okay. So, and how about Joe Wiseman?
I was a PA a year and a half or 2 years before. I was the night PA for Caroline in the City.
So how did you get that job?
I just aged myself. How did I get that job? Oh, that's a good question. So I went to college at the small liberal arts school in Santa Fe called the College of Santa Fe. It's now out of business. Another story.
go out of business.
They send you stuff saying like, contribute to the fund. Like, yeah, they'll be fine. And they were not. They're not fine. I took a business of entertainment class. And at the time, Santa Fe was kind of, Hollywood had a sort of love affair with Santa Fe at the time. They were doing lots of Westerns. And so the guy who taught it was this guy, Larry Sugar, who was sort of like a prominent entertainment lawyer and producer. And the class was on Saturday because he was like once a month, every Saturday, he would fly out someone from working in Hollywood and you would do the class and talk about business. And one time he brought out a lawyer named Bob Myman. And so fast forward a couple years later, I moved to LA. A friend of mine was going to Chapman University in Orange and I need a place to live. I wasn't that familiar with LA. I was living in Denver, where I grew up. And so I went to AAA, got a map of LA. I looked at it. Orange in Orange County is right in the middle of the map. And I'm like, this is perfect.
Now, of course, I know Orange is a completely different county. I drive out here with my Tercel out of everything I own. I get there, I unload. I meet all my roommates, one of whom is Adam Myman, Bob's son. I'll get to that in a second. And I'm like, I'm going to go look at the Hollywood sign. And they're like, what? I'm going to go look. And like, I'm driving and like an hour and a half, I'm like, oh, I moved to the wrong city. So anyways, long short, I became really good friends with Adam, Bob's son. And through that, became family friends. And Bob represented a lot of people who were on Caroline the City, knew I wanted to be a writer and wanted to get into that space and sort of, got me the job.
Okay, and so you did a season as a night PA on Caroline?
Yes.
One season
night PA, which was, it's the worst job in the world. It doesn't exist anymore because I think they just email all the scripts out.
Right, can you explain what the night PA job used to be?
Yeah, it's a nightmare. you go in, you know, in the evening, and basically at the end of the night, after the writers have done the rewrite. And in that case, that show was a late show. They would go to midnight was like early, 2 a.m. was normal.
Whoa.
I would then have to make about 150 copies on the copy machine, which took like an hour and a half, and then distribute all throughout the office. But then I had to drive them to all the cast members, all the guest cast, the director, the high ranking writer. It was anywhere from, you know, 18 to 25 deliveries. And this is before Google Maps. This was like literally
Thomas Guide.
I would about an hour each night. I would have all my delivery addresses, and I would try to calculate the route that was most efficient, so that it would only take me 3 or 4 hours. So I will say, highway system in LA is incredible without traffic. Like it was like there was two benefits. One, I learned the city really well, and two, after I got dinner for all the writers, there was about, you know, 4 to 8 hours of downtime. And because we didn't have cell phones, you know, smart devices or whatever, I basically, after a while, after I was comfortable with everyone, and I said, can I sit in the room and not say anything and literally just watch? And they were cool with that. And so for, you know, good half of the season, I got to sort of like sit in on the room and kind of see how the sausage was made, which was a huge benefit. And then the third benefit was like, you know, I worked hard, everyone liked me. And so the next, season there was a position open for a writer's assistant, actually on a different show that a lot of the people on that show created, called Union Square. So then I was able to become a writer's assistant and be in the room the whole time. And then that show didn't last, but I believe my next job was writer's assistant on Dilbert. So I believe that was the original question how I ended up at, but yeah, so no, that's a long road.
That's one of those tough break-in jobs.
It was rough. Oftentimes I would get home and I was in traffic because people were going to work at 6 a.m.
Oh, that's so impressive.
It was brutal. It was brutal.
I was like the night PA on, I was day and night PA on Dilbert. I didn't know that there was just an IPA.
Because on animated shows, there's no run. Yeah. You know, the reason
you were making those deliveries.
Yes, I was. And I had to make like hundreds of copies. And then, at one time I was making copies. I thought everyone was gone. It was like very late at night. And the copy machine gets very hot. It just generates a lot of heat. So then Wiseman walks in and I'm shirtless making copies.
Just staring at the copy machine.
He screamed.
I think you covered yourself up.
I used to have to drive the scripts out to, like, to some of the actors lived in Malibu, and it was like way the F out there. Then they would always come in like for the table read the next day. And like clearly not have even opened.
Well, they would be holding them. Same with Caroline. They'd be holding the sealed envelope,
open
it up
depressing.
In front of you.
Your whole previous night didn't need to exist
for nothing. Yeah, yeah.
So you both, well, you're doing those jobs because you wanted to be writers.
Mm-hmm.
And had you written scripts on your own before you wrote that spec King of the Hill together?
Yeah.
I had written one script on my own, and I was also like a political cartoonist in college. I liked trying to be funny and writing some stuff. My script with Wiseman was much better than the one I wrote on my own.
I also wrote some bad scripts on my own. When I was a college freshman, I think, at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, this is before Santa Fe, I believe CSU Fort Collins is still in business. It's a state school. For an English class, there was like just an open writing assignment. And I, for some reason, wrote a Cheers script. And the professor was kind of like, oh, yeah, this is, I don't know what to do. No one's ever done this before. But he liked it and then recommended that I go to film school, or if that's what I was interested in. And I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know, like, you could study film. So I then found out CSU does not have a film department and transferred to CU Boulder for a year. That's a whole lot different story. I should never have left. That was really fun. and then at the College of Santa Fe, I saw an ad for a college television writing contest sponsored by Gary David Goldberg. So I wrote a Seinfeld spec and sent it in. And a couple months later, I was notified that I had won. And I got a small stipend. It was like, I think it was $3,000, which at the time was literally all the money I had in the world. And then it was supposed to come with a 6-week internship. So I wrote Gary David Goldberg a letter saying, hey, thank you so much. This is, and inquiring about the internship. And he basically said, I'm kind of stepping away from the business for a little bit. But he wrote me this really like encouraging letter that I have framed, still in my office, basically like, don't give up, keep writing. And so that was sort of like very inspirational. As the years went on, I kept trying to find this writing contest, and I couldn't find it anymore. So I started to sort of like have this thought that like maybe a lot of people didn't enter it, and maybe like who knows? I could have been the only who's writing like what college students are writing spec TV scripts, especially back then. So I actually met him a couple times later, and I wanted to ask like, did no one else enter this contest? But I didn't. I kind of like.
You know, why know that? You
don't. That's the thing. I sort of like. I let me have my illusion.
Thousands of entries.
Whatever. Even if it was, it worked. It that money was all the money I had when I moved out here, and it gave me the confidence.
And
it encouraged me.
Gave you the confidence.
Yeah, for sure.
So did you guys find once you teamed up that the writing became easier?
Yeah. As a team? Yeah. I think it's just it's. It's especially with comedy, it's fun to have somebody else there that you know, you're not just sitting in a room alone. I mean, you know, like it's hard. I find it hard when you're just sitting there just, is this funny? I don't know.
That's the big thing. If you say something and you get a laugh, it's like, okay, we know there's something there. And it's,
yeah, and a lot of writing is a conversation. I mean, that's why, you know, we have these staffs, you know, that are just bigger versions of a writing team. Obviously, it's 10 people and, you know, you're talking it out. You're talking out the story and you can do that in your own head, obviously, and a lot of people do. But I like talking it out with someone else.
And it's handy the same way we have staff. So like it's handy to have someone with a different point of view or a different perspective or a different background and all that stuff.
Yeah. So Dilbert, and then what were the next few jobs after that?
The next job we got, I think, was Son of the Beach, which was probably the best
or was
most
it?
Fun job that we've had.
That was a crazy fun job.
It was the Howard Stern Baywatch spoof.
Parody. Oh, right.
It was
and I was
so
a comedy snob. So when we first got offered that, I was just kind of like, oh, okay, we're going to write this thing. It's just a bunch of boob jokes. And I had so much fun. The guys who
there was
created
dick jokes.
It,
there was not just boob.
It was not, yeah, yes. And then the guys who created it were so funny and really sort of like led us sort of into their circle, and we were able to contribute a lot. And plus we were on the beach, the Tim Stack, one of the guys who created it, was also the star. So the writer's room would basically just go wherever he was, and we shot on the beach a lot. So we're on the beach, you know, just pitching just the most.
And it was, and I was a big Howard fan too. So that was fun. And he almost mentioned our name one time.
Yes.
So is that still, do you look back on that as one of the most fun jobs still?
Yeah.
Probably. So yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. And we were able, it was a very small staff, so we were able to just, it was a good boot camp.
No, we were the staff. We were.
It was Tim, the three guys that
it
created
it. It was Tim, Jim, and Dave, the guys that created it, and then there was us. And we wrote like 8 of the episodes there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great training for one of your first jobs.
Absolutely.
It really was. It was just like
boot camp, yeah.
To churn it out and to like, yeah, it was really helpful and educational.
Mm-hmm.
So that just lasted a season though.
Correct.
Yeah, then we went to Just Shoot Me after that.
Yeah,
right. And you were there for how?
We were just there for the sixth season.
Season six.
Yeah. It was fun. Really liked it.
And after that?
After that, where'd we go?
Directly after that, I don't remember. Like,
we worked on the office for a little bit after that, mm-hmm. and we started developing shows. And
yeah. So, what was the first show you developed that you pitched?
It was called Inseparable. It was. It's literally still like my favorite pilot that we maybe shot. It was Christine Bransky and Ed O'Neill, and they played a couple that had been married, but now had each been married like four other times, right? And it was about their daughter and her new marriage, and all their like steps and exes and all these other people. They were a very close-knit divorce family, so it was like this young couple trying to make their marriage work in the sea of divorce. And it was just a lot of good dynamics, you know. It's like, because this guy's still in love with that person, and you know, it was just like, it was a great cast. Kristen Ritter was in it, Larry Wilmore.
And so that's the first pilot you wrote, you shot.
Yeah, it was very fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it didn't get on.
So. It did not get on. Sure. Even just to shoot your first pilot.
It was amazing. Yeah. Although we were on The Office at the time, and so we had to leave to go shoot it. So it was just sort of like, oh my God, we're going to shoot a pilot. And then we're also like leaving this sort of magical show that was the second season. It was exploding, and it was like bittersweet.
Right.
But yes, it was, the shooting the pilot was fantastic up until the point where it didn't get on.
Yeah. Well,
but the whole process was really fun.
So we haven't talked about what is your process together as writing as a team?
Well, it's changed a little bit over the years, but we generally, you know, talk it out a lot, you know, the story obviously and characters and,
it used to be almost together for every step, face to face, talking it out, and then writing it line by line by line. And we still do a lot of that. I think partly technology and also just partly like, you know, growing and being more confident as individuals, whatever. We've started doing stuff, you know, still with close communication, but like there's
splitting up this.
Yeah, sometimes. You take this scene, you take that scene. But then we always get together and go over it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Someone at the keyboard, someone pacing behind.
Joe Port likes to type. He loves to type.
Okay. Yeah, I like to type. I just like to think that way.
Okay. So that's a consistent, you don't take turns really. You're Joe Port, you're usually.
Occasionally I will, but he likes to.
Sometimes I don't. And that's nice too.
Well, I also like to pace. I like to move around. I like to sort of stare out the window, stuff like that.
And did you experience, I know when Ted, my old partner, and I, you know, when we got to Friends and they split us into two rooms the first time, because we had been on shows and we were a team and we had written together. And we were always in the room together. And the first time, they're like, okay, you go in this room and you go in this room. And it was like, but wait, I don't know how to do this without.
That never bothered me. And first of all, and I know like there is like a kind of belief maybe that, oh, wait, they're not supposed to do that. Or at least early on, you think that.
It feels like there's an injustice because they're still paying us.
To me, I guess that's part of the allure of hiring a team is that you have two people and you can send them off to do whatever.
Right.
And also, we see enough of each other.
Sure.
And how does it, when you're developing, when you're coming up with ideas, what is that process like for you guys?
I don't know. That's just sort of varied. You know, like this year we are writing a pilot for CBS that's based on a British show. So, you know, that's very different than coming up with something from our lives. But I do think we always try to find what's the angle from our life, whether we're writing a show about vampires, like the one that you guys read for the podcast, like that was sort of autobiographical because Wiseman and I have been writing partners for so long. So we were like, what about a show about two people who are stuck together forever? You know, and then so we came up with, oh, this vampire couple that's been married for 500 years. So it's sort of based in, and then we've done other pilots that are, you know, we did a pilot called JoJo and Jane, which is obviously just couldn't be more autobiographical.
Yeah. Jane is the name of my wife.
Right. It didn't occur to me that Eternally Yours was in a way about your partnership. Sort of the most brilliant way of writing about a writing partnership that I've heard.
I listened to, everyone, I don't know if people are reading Written By, because it feels like there's a lot of jokes about people not reading Written By. Like, when it comes,
Written By is the Writers Guild magazine that's sent out to members.
I happen to love Written By. Yeah, and I think there's pearls of wisdom in it. And I read it when around the time we were coming up with that show, I read an article about interviewing Paul Feig about Spy. And that was all about him trying to step into this larger than life mentor's shoes. He was finally doing a movie without Judd Apatow, he said. And so that he was the Melissa McCarthy character, you know? And so I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Like, this has nothing to do with Paul Feig's life, but I guess it does. And that's where we kind of started talking about the vampire thing with us.
Huh. Okay. So while we're there, let's talk about Eternally Yours. So that was really, was that the kernel? Was it reading that story that made you think of that?
I don't remember the inception, or if we were already in the world of vampires and then that
I don't
was something.
Remember where the vampire thing came in.
And I think it might have been something about that, though.
I think you're right. I think you were talking about sort of this interminable relationship.
Right, right.
And sort of if vampires are immortal and what if they didn't believe in divorce?
Right, but I think it was because of reading that article.
Sure. Yeah, I remember you mentioning that. Written By, read it. Yeah. Read it.
Okay, so had you been fans of vampire movies and shows?
I mean, on a casual level, sure, I always enjoy stuff like that, but I wasn't
No.
But then when we sort of pitched it, I dove in and started reading a lot of books and watching movies and whatnot, just to sort of...
And I love that, What We Do in the Shadows. Yes. I haven't seen the TV show yet, but the movie was so good.
Both are great.
I haven't either, but you wouldn't have seen that movie when you were writing this.
Yes, actually, it came out sort of around the same time.
I think it came out at the same time, and that was...
We didn't actually know about it, but then after we started saying this idea, then
people brought it up.
Yeah, and yes. But it was very different. Ours is a family show that's about these four vampire roommates. But I mean, it was great.
I think it was helpful too because just going into, we did this pilot for CBS, and going in there and just mentioning vampires, the person we were pitching to had seen that movie recently and loved it, and sort of was able to get, oh, okay, yes, this is a world that can be mined for comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think it was helpful to have a successful and very funny example to sort of point to.
Right. But the show hadn't, the TV show version of What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, no, that came out, I think. Right. Yeah.
Because people, I know, after we did this read and actors, or everyone's sort of trying to wrap their heads around why this show isn't on television, mm-hmm. why Eternally Yours didn't get picked up. And someone's like, well, maybe it's because of What We Do in the Shadows. Mm-hmm. It's too similar, but that show wasn't on.
No.
And like Jess said, tonally, they're very, very different. Yeah.
They're very different. I think, people are always trying to figure it out. There's got to be an answer to why something this good doesn't get on.
I think at the time that we did it, and first of all, a lot of things don't get on, obviously, and there are a lot of good things that people do that don't get on, but it was a weird outside the box show for CBS at the time. Now maybe CBS would do a show like that, but at the time it was more, they didn't have a lot of single camera shows even.
It's not on brand for...
Correct.
No, and I think it's sort of, once you've done the pilot somewhere, it's hard to get it going somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, it does happen occasionally, but...
And it went to CBS because did you guys write this while you were in a deal with CBS Studios?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
So did you pitch it to all the networks?
We did. But CBS had a lot of enthusiasm.
They were super enthusiastic about it,
And they've got the inside track because it's their in-house studio. Even though it's not really on brand for them, they really liked it. And there's always that belief, well, maybe they'll take a chance.
They only sort of develop. Yeah, exactly.
They never really do.
Sure, yes.
So you had this idea of the couple who are stuck together for hundreds of years, sort of based on your partnership. But where does the brilliant idea of this romantic relationship and him working for the IRS, and that's how he finds out?
I think my friend pitched that there should be a foil who's working for this Social Security Administration, because that would be someone who might track down vampires, because they're around forever.
Right. We were big sort of like Breaking Bad fans, and sort of like, you know, they had the brother-in-law who worked for the DEA, drug enforcement?
DEA.
Okay, yeah. And so we were just sort of like, okay, that's like, seems like a natural sort of like enemy of these people. And we thought there would be some doofus who has been collecting these things, like, this is great, we can just keep collecting this forever.
Right.
And that would sort of be a way in.
And we didn't want to do Vampire Hunter. We just wanted to do more of a bookish.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Foil.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many great twists in just this pilot, that act breaks where the way the reveal happens, and reading this to me, it's just the difference when you read something by a younger writer who may have a lot of raw talent but hasn't been doing it long enough to have the skills to set up and pay off everything. And I felt like in this pilot, even when Max gets hit by the car, you've set that up earlier, that Jesse's boys, you know, he wants to have driving lessons, and you've set up the Trans Am. So it's not like at the end someone randomly gets hit by a bus. He gets hit by something that has been set up earlier. And when it's set up, it doesn't feel like a
setup. Sure. Yeah.
So I guess there's not a question there. There's just sort of a compliment. And I don't know for you guys if those things come along through the process of rewriting and rewriting.
Yes, totally. 100%. I always say that. Like, just rewriting is so much easier than writing the first draft, obviously. Like, Neil Simon has that book, Rewrites.
Yeah.
That's his, like, memoir. And, I mean, it's so true. Like, that's when stuff gets good.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can start adding layers and sort of like, oh, I don't remember exactly how we came up with the car thing, but yeah, sort of like, I obviously it was important to us that it's not just this random thing that happened at the end.
But I'm sure we came up with the ending first. And then
I'm sure that we did.
Yeah.
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 We tried to come up with something character-y to sort of set up. And, you know, Jesse would drive the Trans Am. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's cool.
Because he's very cool.
And I love that he's a physical trainer, and that line he has about the spray tan. And without the spray tan, he'd just be a tank top and some weights going up and down. It must have been fun just figuring out, okay, what are the fun jobs to give to all of these vampires who've been alive?
Yeah, and he's kind of like a douchey bro too, so that seemed like a good fit.
And his whole relationship with Phyllis, and I love how each time she realizes they're vampires, you know, probably for the 100th time, she gets so freaked out. And
they have to wipe her, yeah.
So do you know how many pilots you guys have sold over the years? Do you keep track?
I don't know.
I don't keep track.
You've shot how many?
We shot like
eight
of them. Yeah. Yeah.
And we've probably...
12, maybe?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing. 12 or 13. 13. Yeah. We typically probably do one a year. Some years we've done two. But I think 12 or 13 is probably accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your attitude towards it at this point? I mean, how do you guys don't strike me as jaded and over it, and yet I know how tough it is each time.
I guess I'm trying to be more about the process now, and just like, kind of, some things are so out of your control and you can't, like, there's no point getting all angry about it if it doesn't get on or this or that. Like, I'm just trying to be like, let's just try to make it good and then let the chips fall.
Yeah, I have to feel passionate about something. It's like every time, you know, people sometimes sit down and try to figure out, okay, this place wants this. This is what they do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can come up with an idea that's exciting, but it's ultimately, I think we just have to believe in the project and be excited by it.
And I don't think people even really know what they want. You know, like,
correct.
Greg Garcia famously pitched Earl all around, and he'd already been very successful. Everyone passed on it. At that time, everyone was the four networks.
Right.
And I mean, I don't know how he got the willpower to do this, but he decided, I'm going to spec it anyway. And then, you know, went on to be a big show. I mean, he was speccing it for the four people that had already passed on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But once they read it, you know, then they could understand what it was.
Right. It's a level of confidence that if you can hold on to it, despite all the setbacks that everyone has in a career, that you could go like, you know what, I went in there. Most people, I think you're right. You go in, you pitch. There it was four networks. Now you could probably pitch 15 or 20 places, and everyone passes, and yet you still to have that belief in an idea. Go, you know what? Fuck it.
And I will say, nothing bad has ever happened from writing something for us.
That's a great point.
Like anytime we wrote this spec script for no reason. That was basically it was OJ. You know the People versus OJ show. I love that show.
On FX,
So we wrote season 2, episode 1. Basically, it takes place a couple days after the verdict, and it's like just the adventures of all these, you know, friends that we came to know through the pilot. You know, it's like OJ trying to make up with Bobby Kardashian and all the different adventures. We treated it more like a sitcom, and it did not get made. But it led to like a lot of other good things, you know, and it's just because we had an idea we liked and
it just made us laugh.
Everything always leads to something, it seems like, you know, and I will say this is if we're doing like kind of like, oh, hey, younger writer.
Yeah.
Stuff. You know, Joe was talking about having a good attitude at like this crappy job that he had. And there's a lot of bad shows that we've worked on and that everybody who's been around for a while has worked on. And we've worked on some good shows, too. But if you just have like if you do a good job at a bad show, that always comes back and something good happens.
All those people are going to go do other stuff.
Yes.
And they'll remember and it all.
Yep. Just have a good attitude.
Yeah.
And I haven't always had a good attitude at every show, but I know when you do, people notice it.
Yeah. It doesn't pay to feel like you're above the show you're working
on. Of course, absolutely not.
It gets you nowhere. You're more miserable.
Yep. Right.
People don't have a good feeling about you.
Exactly.
And
the worst thing that can happen if you write something is no one likes it. So what?
Right.
They're not going to like it if you don't write it.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is all solid advice, people, writers out there. Hope you're listening. But how do you avoid trying to figure out why something didn't go and learn lessons from that? Because I agree, it is a useless endeavor because there's an endless number of lessons and there's a randomness to it. And you can never solve this puzzle. You can never figure out, okay, I know why that one didn't go and I'm going to correct that mistake the next time. But do you fall into that?
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. No. And I think and you want to, cause you want to, you care and you want to know, and you want to not repeat mistakes or want to have information, but it's this balance, between caring too much and caring too little. And I think this applies to almost every level of writing. Even like when we would write scripts for shows, you always have your favorite jokes. And invariably, especially like on multicams where you have to go through the grinder of the daily run-throughs and the rewrites, that joke is almost always jettisoned at some point along the way. And that sucks, but it also isn't important. Like there's other jokes, there's other things. So it's like, and it's for me, like I say, it's a balance. Like you want to care and you want to feel that pain because you want to know that you're creating something that means something to you. But at the same time, it's all moving. It's all like, it's you have to embrace that there's things you can't control and that's how it is. So
no, but I'll think of like, I'll be like thinking of like, oh, we should have done this in the cold open of this pilot from like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And sometimes
he'll text me saying this, and I'm like, well, are you talking about this pilot from 6 years ago?
But I think that's all in service of, it's okay to try to figure out what wasn't perfect about it. And also it's, you know, knowing it's not a meritocracy and it's not necessarily that some things, you know, they just wanted to pick up the show that had that one actor in it or something instead of your thing. But
you also have to pick yourself up, dust yourself off and get back in there. You know, it's like,
Learn writing lessons too.
Of course.
If you feel like you could have done something better, then just that's good to know for the next time.
Sure.
I remember Rebounding, which is a pilot you guys wrote that I just absolutely loved. I think this is just a fantastic pilot.
Oh, thank you.
obviously the ones that are more personal
sure.
have to be harder when they don't go.
Uh-huh.
But have you generally felt like the grieving process gets shorter when these things don't go each time, or does it depend on just how much you love the project?
It depends. You know, with network, there's a schedule. So it's like you find out things, if it is shot, you find out in May if it's going to go or not. And if it's not, you find out in the next couple of weeks, late January, early February, whether it's going to get shot. And then once you find that out, there usually is downtime to sort of wallow in it. And then, you know, come staffing time, you get busy again. So to me, there's sort of like a natural built-in mourning period. And then you kind of just have to move on with your life.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned rebounding. You know, that was obviously very autobiographical. That was about my fiance passed away. And then it was about the group of friends who I played basketball with who helped me, you know, get past that and move on. And it was, I loved the pilot. I thought it was great. And Will Forte was great in it. But you talk about the grieving process, you know, the language is particular. Yeah. But I will say, you know, that's like a perspective thing. So what? It's a fucking pilot. It doesn't get on.
Right. You have a unique perspective.
So
right?
Yeah, there's much worse things than if a show doesn't go. Yeah. And you're lucky to be writing for a living. And so it hurts if a pilot doesn't get on, but it's also not the end of the world.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, have you guys pretty much stayed in network television? Have you done
stuff? We've worked on some cable stuff, but we've mostly done network pilots. Yeah. But we want to do some streaming stuff.
But you haven't yet. Mm-hmm. And you talk about just how it feels now in this completely different world. Yeah. I guess you guys are very established and in-demand writers in network TV, and network TV still has a draw. I'm sort of asking this because I feel like I'm in a similar sure. place. You know, I've also pretty much my career has been in network television, and we've all come up in a system that doesn't really exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We all came up in the 4 or 5 network world. And it still can be a quite lucrative world to work in. And it's, everyone knows you and they bought your stuff. And
I think there's also like this thought that nobody's watching it. Like I go, you know, my wife is from Nebraska. I went home for Christmas to visit with her family. Every house we went to, CBS was on. So a lot of people are watching it, you know, it's like, it's just, I think maybe in LA, we feel like everyone's just watching, you know, streaming. But I also just think it's going to become very less of a difference, you know, like remember they had the Cable Ace Awards at one time and then everything just became one thing. And I mean, I'm trying to also say this for our own benefit because like, I think I want to move into that world more and, I just think it's sort of all, it's a lot of the same people playing in the different ponds.
Yeah. I guess the biggest difference becomes how you tell stories in these streaming services. If they're dumping all the episodes at once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very different way of writing.
Yeah.
And if you're doing a show for CBS and there's going to be one each week,
mm-hmm.
it just is. You just end up having to write differently. That to me is really the only significant difference as a writer.
Like more serialized, you mean?
A serialized thing. And also that you know, we've all come up in this system where someone might come in at episode 5
mm-hmm.
and it's a new show and they want you to make sure that someone can come in episode 5 and be caught up and not feel like they've missed anything. Whereas if you're doing a show for a streaming service, someone's watching episode 5, they've watched episodes 1 through 4.
Sure.
You know, that's just how it works. And so you have somewhat of freedom to not have to re-up the pilot each time. And, you know, that serialized way of, mm-hmm. right, you can assume everyone knows what's going on here and make callbacks. And that's still not the case with the CBS, you know, the network
mm-hmm.
kind of world.
But that just seems like a fun other way of thinking. And I mean, it doesn't seem that different, I guess, in terms of like nuts and bolts. It's just, you know, just different.
Yeah. What other lessons have you guys learned from, you know, your years doing this that you could share if there are people wanting to do this job listening?
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, I feel like I've already mentioned some, you know, work hard and be nice. Be a person that people, a lot of this job is spending 10 hours a day with people, and people don't want to hang out with assholes, you know?
Yeah. My mom told me when I moved out here, she has a lot of like catchphrases, and she was like, be in the vicinity. And she would say it like that. but she meant, basically she was right, because she was, you know, getting the PA job. And obviously we talked about that's not like so easy to get, but if you get those kind of jobs, versus just doing a different job that might allow you more time and even more money, you're not going to be in the vicinity. You know, like we got hired to be writers on Dilbert because Larry Charles read our script, but he read our script because he knew us, you know, and we were not just names in a stack.
Right.
And he liked us.
And what mistakes, you know, when you guys have run shows and been on staffs and younger writers come in, first job, perhaps, have you seen mistakes that those young writers have made on staff?
Yeah, it's hard because, like, you know, sometimes I think people come in and maybe try too hard. And you can also have the opposite, too, where maybe people sort of, like, pull back a little bit. But it's hard, especially, that's where, like, when I was the night PA and I was able to sit in the room, I was sort of able, without any expectation, just to sit there and observe and learn. And obviously each room is different as well. But yeah, I think so maybe sometimes coming in and trying to do too much, might be the most common mistake from like a brand new writer that I've seen.
And what do you guys look for when you're hiring?
Also, I would just say pitching fixes is good if you're
yes.
new to the room and young, and I don't think people want to hear from just the perspective from that, even from anyone really, but from that level.
Yeah, you may have to resist pointing out some problems that you don't have solutions right. to as a younger writer, yeah. and maybe someone else will bring them up.
But sure.
That is a common mistake I've seen. Like, yeah, it's good for someone to point out the problems.
You don't have to have the best fix, but give a direction. Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you saying?
I was just saying, when you're hiring people, when you've been in positions where you're looking at writers to hire these days, like what are you looking for in material that you read? Or
well, that's interesting because there's this like raging debate on Twitter now about like, does anyone want to read specs of original or of existing shows? And a lot of people, I don't know why anyone gets angry on either side of this, but it feels like there's angry
but there's no right or wrong answer. Yeah.
But
I think they're just on Twitter, so they feel like they have
yes,
to be
angry. Yes, I guess that's true.
That's the default setting on Twitter. It's angry.
But I don't know why no one writes specs anymore. I guess there's not like a set of agreed upon shows that...
I think that's the biggest problem is you have no way of guaranteeing that the showrunner is going to have any idea what the show is.
Yeah, because that is the job, is sort of being able to mimic another voice in a way. That's the job that you're signing up for when you're on staff.
And I'm sure that I've read specs of shows that I was not familiar with, and you can tell if it's well written. You can tell if the characters are clear and standing out. You can tell if the jokes are funny. You can tell if the story is something that, you know, would be on television. So I don't think, look, as far as that debate goes, there is no wrong answer. Write something.
You write a great pilot, that's amazing. But I think we look for interesting voices, interesting perspectives, you know, somebody that has like a good handle on story. You know, that's very helpful because you can always lay some jokes on top of things.
Yes.
Obviously, you have to be funny, but I feel like the being able to have a good structure mind is rare. So those people are very attractive.
I guess it comes down to you have a huge stack, a digital stack of scripts, right? And what rises to the top? Does the spec of man seeking woman, I'm just trying to think of a show that you might not know, or does an original pilot rise to the top of that?
I mean, I guess if I really didn't know the show, then maybe the spec might be a little bit. But honestly, like when we've sort of met with people for possible staffing on a show of ours, you get so many scripts that the best way to get read is to have someone recommend you, someone that we know. Like, that's the number one. If someone says, hey, I think this person got sent to you, they're great, they immediately move to the top of the list.
Right.
But also the ones that are really good, that those stand out quickly. Like, it's not like, it doesn't take 30 pages to know that it's really good. Like, you can read 5, 6, 7 pages and you're like, oh, this is very good.
Yeah. All right, I know you guys have a pilot this season and you're about to get some notes on it.
Yay.
So let's wrap up.
Okay.
It was amazing to get to read this pilot. I just absolutely loved it.
Well, like Joe said, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was such a treat to hear it read by a cast, and such a great cast. You guys get such funny people, and it was so fun.
Yeah.
When's this airing?
I don't know.
Okay.
But it's airing now for people that are listening, right at this very moment for you guys. All right. Thanks,
Joe. All right. Thank you so much.
That's it for our show this month. This show is produced by Ben Blacker and myself and our associate producer, Noah Findling. Thanks to everyone at the Hollywood Improv. Subscribe to the podcast. You know, were you excited when this showed up in your feed? Did it seem like a nice little breath of fresh air? Well, that's good. So subscribe. You can follow us if you want to find out when the shows are going to be rescheduled. I think you got more important things to do right now than leave a review, so I'm not going to bug you about that. We're going to be coming back in a month, and we got a show for you the month after that. So we really hope you enjoyed this and brightened your day a bit. All right, everybody, stay safe. Until next time, I'm Andrew Reich. Thanks for listening.